So the next section of the Satipatthana Sutta brings in a kind of a different direction for our practice. And interestingly, as I was coming over here, I thought, oh, I should bring the sutta, and then I thought, oh, I don't need that. But now I'm realizing I had intended to read sections of it to you, so I'm just going to have to paraphrase it. I know it relatively well, so hopefully this will give you the flavor. So this next section of the Satipatthana Sutta is a pointing to a shift towards bringing our practice into all activities, into the fullness of our lives, and not just into sitting meditation, into formal practice. In fact, I think it's kind of interesting. One thing, I think it's Anaglio, points out that the instruction about finding a secluded place and sitting cross-legged is connected explicitly to the first practice, the breathing practice, the practice of mindfulness while breathing. But that's not repeated anywhere else in the text. So the only practice in the Satipatthana Sutta in which there's the direct encouragement to sit in order to do the practice is with the mindfulness of breathing. And to me, this is important and powerful. It's not to say that we're not supposed to practice other things in sitting practice, but I think that at least this is not my understanding of it. It's not that we're not that we're being told to not practice the other things in sitting meditation, but that we are more explicitly being encouraged to practice the range of mindfulness practices in all of our activities, in everything that we do. And these next two exercises really explicitly point to that. The first one, I'm just going to cover these next two tonight. The next one is the mindfulness of body postures. It's a very simple instruction. It goes something like, when sitting, one understands I'm sitting. When walking, one understands I'm walking. When lying, sitting, standing, walking, sitting, standing. When standing, one understands I'm standing. And when lying down, one understands I'm lying down. And so just the simple recognition or acknowledgement of the various postures that we're in. The awareness, the understanding while sitting. We know that we're sitting. So it brings in a conscious awareness of our bodily postures into our practice to begin to encourage us to recognize what we're doing all day long. And so this points to continuity of practice. This is a big piece of these next two exercises, I feel, that it really is pointing us to. It's not just about being mindful when you're sitting down. It's about cultivating this abide, contemplating, standing while standing, walking while walking. Fully aware, diligent, setting aside greed and distress for the world. So it is this encouragement to continue the practice from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep at night. And actually, possibly even, there's the possibility of falling asleep mindfully, waking up mindfully. So this is the encouragement for us. I think this, the framing of this, when walking, one understands I am walking. When standing, one understands I'm standing. When sitting, one understands I'm sitting. Points to an awareness, a simple awareness of posture and change of posture, as opposed to deliberately controlling posture. It's possible we can, and when we sit down in our meditation posture, we often find a posture, we deliberately, potentially, find a posture in which the mindfulness can be connected and established. That's a way in which there's a deliberateness sometimes to our posture in sitting. I certainly have this, and I have a specific posture for lying in particular, and find that, you know, having that deliberateness about posture in the meditation, in the formal meditation, actually supports the meditation. It supports the mind to, it's like it remembers, oh yes, in this posture, we are awake. And yet the practice here encourages us to expand that alertness and that awakeness to not just those deliberate postures, but all of our postures. As I was even reading this section and reflecting on it, I was sitting in my chair and I was noticing, sitting, I know that I'm sitting while I'm sitting. And I'd make little shifts and I would just be aware of the little shifts as I was moving and while reading about this. And this also is a piece of this practice. I believe, I understand this to be a piece of the practice, that we are not only aware that we are sitting, but the establishing, again, we're establishing mindfulness here. And so we practice understanding when sitting, know that you're sitting. And this is what I was entering into. Sitting, know that I was sitting. And what happened was that I very naturally became aware of these subtle shifts of posture. And so the establishment or the understanding creates the conditions for not only just being aware that you're sitting, but also aware of subtle shifts of posture and potentially even the intentions that prompt those shifts of posture. And so this can also be understood as a piece of this practice. So not only about body, not only about just purely noticing body, but also recognizing how mind and body influence each other, inform each other. So in this exploration of when sitting, know that you're sitting, and then becoming aware of minor postural adjustments, we can become aware of a subtle impulse and intention to move before we move. And also, in terms of this kind of practice, the changing between postures, going from sitting to standing, from standing to walking, we can become aware of the intention, the shift in the mind, a subtle kind of impulse in the mind that carries us into the next action. This is a very powerful aspect of our meditation practice, of our practice, to begin to recognize this feedback between body and mind, this conditionality. We've been talking a lot about conditionality and recognizing conditions, recognizing how things unfold and why they unfold. And this is a big piece of this. This simple practice around noticing the postures is a very natural doorway into noticing intention, this shift or impulse in the mind. We can know we're going to move before we move. We can also know we're going to speak before we speak. We can know we're going to think before we think. But this avenue of exploring the postures begins to really open us to this aspect of our minds, this important aspect of our minds. The no movement happens. Well, maybe I shouldn't say no movement. The vast majority of our movements happen following an intention, following a mental kind of push. There's something in our mind that motivates the movement. Small postural adjustments, the shift from sitting to standing, those are all motivated by an intention in the mind. And connected with that intention, what we can also start to see is we see that impulse. If you're sitting there following a meal and you notice the impulse to go get some more food, seconds or thirds, or another piece of that chocolate. If you're curious about this aspect of practice, of the intention to move, you'll not only notice that you're going to get up, but also you may have a sense of the reason, of the motivation, the motivation associated with that impulse. So not only do our impulses condition our physical actions, there's also associated with that impulse another mental kind of skew, perhaps, that flavors or impels the intention. And so the intention to stand right there in that example of wanting to get seconds, it wasn't just a random blip, I want to stand up. There was a thought of more chocolate. There was a thought, perhaps, a feeling of, ooh, that would be pleasant. A desire, I want that. All of that setting in motion, the urge, the impulse to stand. And so in this exploration of postures, we can start to see the impulse, start to see this moment where action is conditioned, and begin to understand, is the motivation or reason why we are choosing to act, is it a helpful one? Is it a purpose that serves us? Is it onward leading? Now, I'm not saying that you should not take seconds, but I would like to encourage you to notice what's going on there. What's the motivation? What's the... And to notice that impulse. This place of noticing the impulse, the movement of mind before we act, it's got a couple of powerful pieces to it. So, you know, this is a practice that in our everyday activities can begin to open us to recognizing just how little sense of self, or that the sense of self that we usually think of as motivating, like I want to get up and get that chocolate, that sense of self is kind of a construction based on habits and patterns of, you know, things arising in the mind, a thought arising, you know, finishing a piece of chocolate, noticing it's gone, no more chocolate on the plate. The idea arising in the mind that more chocolate would be pleasant. The urge arising conditioned on that thought to want to get more. All of this is just the processes unfolding in the mind. Sometimes we can watch this kind of thing unfold and it's kind of like, wow, who's in charge here anyway? I mean, who's doing this? As we see this unfold, we begin to understand that the sense of self that we appropriate is actually, it can be constructed after the fact. It's almost like, you know, so all of these things arise almost without our conscious awareness. But then when we get up to go get the chocolate, it's like, yeah, I want that. I'm going to get it. And I'm doing it. And yet the whole thing has unfolded through these just arisings, and it conditions the next one, the next one, the next one. So this observation and exploration around postures can begin to open us to this understanding. It begins to open us also to the understanding, deep understanding of conditionality. That it's not things that are not happening randomly. Our actions are motivated by conditions. And it also begins to point us to this moment when we see that, when we can start to land in the present moment fully enough to start to see these intentions. We can know we're going to move before we move. We can know we're going to act before we act. When we can see that, there's a way in which we can have a choice. This moment of noticing intention before action opens us to a huge possibility of choice. When we can see that moment, we often can in that moment recognize, well, this may be, do I really want to do this? Is this purposeful? Is this onward leading? Is this something that supports freedom? And so it offers us a little, seeing this intention offers us a little window in which to choose whether to act or not. Now, this kind of exploration can get us a little stuck sometimes. I've watched doing walking meditation, for instance. I was exploring noticing the postural changes, so walking and then coming to a stop. Pretty clear why I came to a stop, because I was approaching a wall. Okay, that's a good reason to stop. So stopping. And then I'd stand there and I would notice this intention to turn. And I would be standing there curious about the whole process of shifting postures and noticing that intention. And I'd stand there and I'd notice this urge to move, and I'd notice it was connected with boredom. It's like, oh, I'm standing here. I'm ready to get on with it. Okay, well, that's that. So I'd notice the boredom, and I wouldn't turn, because I thought, well, that's not a wholesome motivation. So I'd stand there, and then a little while later, there'd be another urge, and it would be greed or frustration, and I'd stand there for a long time. I reported this to my teacher. This was in Burma. I reported this to my teacher. And he kind of laughed. And he said, just note standing 5 times and then turn around. And that actually was helpful to me, because, you know, I realized that basically I was standing there waiting for an intention to turn. And much of the time when our intentions arise spontaneously, they are connected to habits. They are connected to old motivations. And, you know, so that's what I was seeing. I was seeing kind of these old habits and motivations that would motivate why I would do things. Very useful to see that. Very useful to see just how much, just subtle, like, shifts of mind of boredom or frustration or greed or confusion will motivate action. And yet what he pointed to there is you can also consciously decide to do something. And so this is what he was pointing to, just like, decide to turn and turn, as opposed to waiting until some impulse arose to turn, but doing it consciously. And so I would come to the end of my path, I'd notice standing, and then I would notice deciding to turn, and then I would turn. So sometimes if we are simply waiting for the intention to arise and noticing the motivation associated with it, that can get us a little bit stuck. One teacher I heard a story about said that he was noticing He was looking at the same kind of thing, standing at his door, waiting for the intention to open the door. And he was noticing very similarly to what I described, a whole bunch of kind of intentions that weren't so helpful. But what he was curious about is what was the intention that was going to prompt the action? You know, what was it that was going to do it? And he said, it was remembering I had chocolate in my room. So agreed. You know, that's what, it was like a little moment of the greed taking over, and there he was in his room. And, it, you know, you just have to kind of laugh at this. So be playful with this kind of exploration. I want to encourage that, rather than it having to be I'm seeing the intention. It's associated with frustration, so I shouldn't do anything. You know, don't let this kind of practice feel like it's hamstringing you from action. Just be curious. Notice, kind of like that other teacher pointing to being curious about what is it that motivates you into action. Be curious about. Be playful. Be playful about it. Another aspect of this practice, and I find it interesting that they are in the foundation of body, these two, the body postures and awareness of activities, the second practice I'm going to speak of this afternoon. But in both cases, I think there's a lot of interweaving between what can be understood in the body and it opening us to a recognition of mental experience also. And so this simple practice of just being curious about body postures and being aware of movement in postures begins to open us up to the landscape of intention very naturally. And so I want to encourage not thinking that we have to like exclude other things while we're paying attention to body. We're attending to body as kind of the terrain in which mindfulness is being established. But again, we're talking about the establishment of mindfulness here, which allows us to see a lot more. It's almost what Gil was talking about this morning, the periphery of attention. We establish mindfulness with the attention on the postures, and in the periphery we can notice intention. We can notice other things because mindfulness is becoming established. And it, if we're not trying to focus, if we're not trying to like put other things aside, it very naturally can become a very broad kind of mindfulness, taking in connections between body and mind, for example. So another area that can be revealed, I would say, in this exploration of posture is how posture reflects and can impact the state of our mind. And so, if you find yourself sitting kind of slumped over, maybe at your meal like this, you know, is there some way in which that posture reflects something going on in the mind? A frustration, a mild depression, or maybe just a disconnection, an unawareness, that kind of a habitual posture we've gone into because we've lost kind of a sense of the continuity of mindfulness. And so our postures can reflect our mind states. And in another interesting feedback loop, changing our posture can feed back into our mind. And so if we find ourselves kind of slumped and notice that there's a kind of a heaviness of mind associated with that, a mood or a frustration or a something, you can explore, and again, being playful about this, not trying to make anything happen, but just see, but what happens if I just sit up and let my shoulders relax back and let my belly relax. What happens if I adjust the posture? What happens to the mind? Just play with it right now. Let yourself kind of collapse and see, how does that feel? You know, there's feels in the body. How does it feel in the body? Just notice how it feels, you know, in the mind. It might not be much major. But now sit, let yourself sit up. Let your shoulders come back. Let your belly relax, open. And how does that feel in the mind? Is there any notice, you notice any difference in the mind? There is, sometimes it can be subtle, sometimes it can be obvious. You don't have to really, you know, dig for it. But it's just something that we can be curious about, this connection between body and mind, the posture of our body, how our body is placed, and what's happening in our mind. It's not a one-way feedback. It's not just how our mind is affects our body. We can, how our body is can impact our mind. One place to play with this is in the walking practice. And I sometimes like to encourage in the walking, to start in the walking by just like checking into the pace of the walking. Find a pace that lets the body and mind feel easeful and comfortable. So you can walk a little faster, walk a little slower, and see how does that that pace feed back into our mental experience. Is there a particular pace where the mind just kind of goes, ah, yeah, that's comfortable? In my experience, with the pace of movement, there's a certain pace of movement that can be very naturally in sync with where the mind wants to be mindful in that moment. And we can kind of attune to that through this checking in to the posture and the pace, checking into the pace of walking. So that would be a potentially a way to explore the posture of walking and how it impacts the mind. So at the beginning of your walking, just play with the pace. Walk a little slower, a little faster. Find the pace that feels really comfortable, where the mind feels at ease, the body feels at ease. And see what happens around that. The next encouragement in the Satipatthana Sutta is awareness of everyday activities. This expands and broadens on the postures. It says things like, when going forward and returning, one acts in full awareness. When reaching and when extending and bending the arms, one acts in full awareness. When speaking and remaining silent, one acts in full awareness. When eating, when carrying one's robes and bowls, so when dressing, when serving oneself the meal, when in our everyday activities, one acts in full awareness. When urinating and defecating, one acts in full awareness. That is in the suttas. The encouragement to be mindful in the most mundane of our daily activities. What we think of as the most mundane of our daily activities. Going to the toilet. The encouragement to act in full awareness. So again, to me, this encourages continuity, a little bit perhaps a deepening of the continuity. Every activity, wherever we are, brushing our teeth. I mean, we could write a sutta for IRC. When wiping the tables, one acts in full awareness. When stirring the oatmeal, one acts in full awareness. When mopping the bathroom floors, one acts in full awareness. Whatever we're doing, act in full awareness. So the language is a little different than the postures section. In the postures section, it was pretty simple. It said, when walking, one understands, I am walking. In this one, it says, when going forward and coming back, when going and returning, one acts in full awareness. And so this brings in the term full awareness, which is a piece of the phrase that we explored the other day. One abides, contemplating body as a body, diligent, fully aware, mindful, freed from desires and distress. So it's a piece of the overall instructions. This phrase, full awareness, is a piece of the overall instructions for our practice. But it's highlighted here in this particular section. The Pali term is sampajanya, and the derivation of that term, Anālayo, points to two parts to that word. The second part, the pajanya part, is related to the word pajanati, which means something like knowing, aware, understanding. The sam part, the beginning, sampajanya, means with. So it's a kind of an intensification prefix. So with knowing, something like that. Clearly knowing. Various translations include full awareness, clear comprehension, fully aware, alert, fully alert, things like that. Those are translations that for this term, sampajanya. So what is this encouragement to be fully aware in our activities? Part of the sense of this, just in terms of the context of this particular part of the sutta, is to encourage attention to all activities, nothing left out. That there's no activity that's outside of the realm of our mindfulness practice. Whatever we're doing can be included. And so it really, again, highlights the continuity. So that's a piece, perhaps, of full awareness, that we are encouraged to be aware at all times. Now that's a really high bar. Awareness at all times. And it is what we explore the possibility of. We explore that it maybe is possible to be aware throughout our day. And yet, the mind will get caught. It absolutely will get caught. And so to not have a kind of the idea that if I am not mindful all day long, that I'm failing. It's more of the intention that we're exploring here. That this is whenever I notice that I've been lost, that I reconnect. This is what I'm exploring, being aware. I notice that I've been lost when I'm out doing sweeping. And here I am, I'm sweeping. When sweeping, one acts with full awareness while sweeping. Just including that. And it can be simple. It's not, again, my sense of the establishment of mindfulness is that these simple activities of being aware while walking, understanding one is walking while walking, by being fully aware while sweeping, is not that we're trying to dig in and see things so much, but more just beginning to establish that we know that we're aware while we're doing this activity. And with that, mindfulness begins to get established. And as mindfulness is more established, it begins to reveal more and more about what's going on. And so while sweeping, just being there in full awareness while sweeping, maybe at first it's just the obviousness of the broom and the smells and the feeling of the air on your body. And then maybe there's a feeling of contraction in your stomach and you notice that. And then there's a recognition of a thought that went through the mind that had a little bit of, oh, it's almost time for breakfast, and oh, I've got to finish this quickly. A little bit of a clench in the mind. And so the establishment of mindfulness begins to reveal things that are available to be known. This is at least part of my understanding about how the establishment of mindfulness works. We explore the simple of what's obvious and keep connecting with that. What's obvious? What can be easily known? And as we connect with what's easily known, it's like another layer begins to reveal itself of other things that can now be more easily known because there's a little more continuity of mindfulness. And so it's not so much about digging, but being curious. It's more like being available for this mindfulness to begin to show us what's going on. So not just the bodily activities, but also what's going on in our minds. So this is a piece, I think, of full awareness, that we are available to see what's going on. Available to see the various interrelationships between body and mind. So the term itself, sampajanya, clear comprehension, there's not particularly a description of it in this sutta. It just says one acts with full awareness. It doesn't tell you how to do that. There's a couple of other places in the suttas that give a little bit more context for what full awareness or clear comprehension, what this word is. So I'd like to explore that because I think it will help to flesh out what this practice is of acting in full awareness while sweeping, while extending and bending one's arms, while urinating and defecating. So one place that this kind of a way that it's defined is, and I mentioned this the other day, that feelings, thoughts and perceptions are understood as they arise, persist, and pass away. It says this is one's clear comprehension. That feelings, thoughts, and perceptions are understood as they arise, persist, and pass away. So when I read this, I thought, well, that's really interesting. Because right there's an encouragement to go beyond body awareness, because feelings, thoughts, perceptions are activities of mind. And so, and in particular here, it's encouraging a recognition or an inclining towards the understanding of impermanence. The impermanence of feeling, thoughts, and perceptions in particular here. So this is an aspect of full awareness, that it's not just about knowing that we are walking while we're walking. But again, so my understanding here is that this is when clear comprehension is established, this is what it can see. Feeling, thoughts, perceptions as they arise, persist, and pass away. I could take a whole talk to describe what each of those is, what feelings, thoughts, perceptions are. Right now, let's just expand it to experience is understood as it arises, persists, and passes away. So the kind of inclining towards the understanding that experience arises, lasts for a while, and then passes away. So an encouragement to orient towards the changing nature of our experience. To me, that's a piece of what acting in full awareness is pointing to. And this brings in wisdom. It brings in a couple of pieces that point to how this practice of wise mindfulness begins to free the mind, begins to help us release the ways that we're clinging to experience, the ways that suffering is created in our minds, in our hearts and minds. So one of the things that this points to, experience is understood as it arises, it persists and changes. To me, this is again pointing to the human aspect. It's not about me. It's pointing to this is the nature of experience in general. This impermanent nature of experience. And to point to the impermanence in particular here begins to undermine begins to point out that clinging and trying to hold on to things, trying to construct the world to be the way we want it to be is destined to create stress, suffering, struggle. Because any time we try to construct things in some way, it's already falling apart. It's already vanishing. It's already letting go. And so if we are pinning our hopes for happiness on that thing that we've constructed, it's going to go away. And so this, again, begins to point to the wisdom that the Buddha says freed him in his journey. This understanding that craving for things to be a certain way is the linchpin of how and why we suffer. And so this encouragement to act in full awareness while doing what we do in our days, to me, is an encouragement. These two pieces of recognize this is what it's like for a human being to be sweeping, for one. You know, this is a human's experience of sweeping. This is a human's experience of table wiping. It is this body doing activity. And to recognize how experience changes in that activity. So it's kind of an orientation to what we are noticing. Not that it is me sweeping, that it is me table wiping, but that it is activity unfolding and a changing process unfolding. So this may not be something to try to do. I think of this more as a kind of an inclination of mind to be more curious about how might impermanence reveal itself while sweeping. To not have to try to find it, but just more like, just be curious and let that be a kind of a question held in the mind. How might impermanence reveal itself? How might change reveal itself in this simple activity? Again, I feel that this including of full awareness in the bodily activities brings in the broader awareness that we're not just narrowing down to observe sweeping, 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 and focusing only on the body side of it. But the full awareness to me opens it to a more broad understanding, a broader kind of awareness that can recognize feelings, thoughts happening while we're doing activity and noticing the flow, the changing nature of our experience, our moods, our mind states. Another aspect of full awareness of this term, sampajanya, is it's used in a context that, and so in this case, it's not defining it. The last definition I gave, that feeling, thoughts, and perceptions are understood as they arise, persist, and pass away. This is clear comprehension. That's more of a definition of clear comprehension. In these other places, it's more that this term, sampajanya, is used in relationship to other things. And so it says that one can perform volitional activity either with or without full awareness, or without clear knowing. And to me, this points to the way that our intentional activities, our volitional activities, sometimes we're spaced out while we're doing them. So this points to the conscious awareness piece of our mindfulness practice, that we know that we know. So the term sampajanya in this one text is said, volitional activity can be performed with sampajanya, with clear knowing, or volitional activity can be performed without clear knowing. And we all know this. And many of us, probably most of us, have driven a car without clear knowing. So this points to, the clear knowing piece here points to some extent to this aware of activity while it's happening, knowing that we know. Now this is something that we often associate with the word mindfulness. Sometimes I even use that as a kind of a working definition for mindfulness, that we know that we know. But in this text, it really associates it with clear comprehension. And so in some ways, I think sometimes the word sati sampajanya is used, mindfulness and clear comprehension together, as being the foundation for the unfolding of wise mindfulness. So bringing together the mindfulness, that recognition of experience, and the clear knowing. But in this case, also the clear knowing, including something of wisdom, not just knowing what's happening in the present moment. I mean, we can imagine, for instance, a thief engaging in the intentional activity of stealing and being clearly aware while they're acting. A thief breaking into a house and being very careful, maybe somebody's in the house, very careful not to wake them up. So, very consciously aware of what they're doing. This is not what I think full awareness means. There is, in that case, you know, there's a kind of the skew of greed that's informing the desire to be present in the moment. And this is why the perspective of wise mindfulness is necessary for us to wake up. Because no matter how much a thief is mindful and aware, maybe we shouldn't even use mindful there, but just consciously aware of their activity, no matter how much they're consciously aware while they're doing it of their activity, that is not going to lead to liberation. It's going to lead to more greed, because that's the motivation behind it. And so the encouragement with clear comprehension, with mindfulness and clear comprehension, is to understand also the purpose of leading towards freedom, of understanding what's skillful and what's unskillful in respect of skillful qualities of mind tend to take us towards freedom, take us away from greed, away from aversion, away from delusion. Unskillful qualities of mind tend to be based in greed, aversion, and delusion, and tend to reinforce those patterns. And this is another aspect of clear comprehension. There's another sutta, I'll read this section. In this case, the Buddha is saying, lack of clear comprehension causes unwholesome qualities to arise in the mind. And here's the quote. I do not see even a single thing that so causes unarisen, unwholesome qualities to arise and arisen wholesome qualities to decline as lack of clear comprehension. I do not see a single thing that so causes unarisen, unwholesome qualities to arise, so unarisen anger to come up, or arisen wholesome qualities to decline, so for instance, love to decline, concentration to decline, as lack of clear comprehension. For one who does not clearly comprehend, unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities decline. So this is tying the definition or the direction of clear comprehension and full awareness to an understanding of what takes us towards freedom and what takes us towards suffering. When we're not fully aware, and when we're not conscious, it's not just about full awareness, because as I said in that example, the thief is fully aware, but not so conscious of the greed that's motivating it and the suffering that's coming around that greed that's motivating that. In fact, there's a lot of delusion there, thinking that this is benefiting them in some way. So it's not just about being clearly aware, but also with this understanding of the perspective that it's useful to understand what leads towards suffering and what leads towards non-suffering. When we are acting from our habits, it tends to be that when we're acting out of unawareness, our habits tend to be running the show. And when we are first start practicing, I'd say those habits tend to be based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And so when we are not aware and not consciously aware, we tend to be reinforcing our habits and patterns from our conditioning. And yet as we go on in the practice, as we cultivate establishing mindfulness with this skillful perspective, that itself can begin to become a habit, so that sometimes even when we're not aware, our mind can find its way to wholesomeness. It's quite delightful to begin to see that. Actually, I'll just drop this in. This just arose in my mind, so I'll drop this in. Sometimes I notice when the mind wanders. So the mind wanders, it becomes unaware. Mind loses awareness. At the beginning of my practice, pretty much when the mind wandered, it wandered off into something, I was thinking about or confused about, or some argument that I was having with somebody 3 weeks ago or something. And I would often find when my mindfulness returned that I was caught in some kind of reactivity. And so that's the habits of mind, kind of leading the mind down the garden path of what it's used to doing. And yet, the more I practice, the more I cultivate this skill of establishing mindfulness and the skill of wholesome mindfulness, the more I notice that sometimes when my mind wanders, actually it's kind of paradoxical at this point. It's almost like sometimes when this happens, in retrospect, what I notice is that the mind has been a little too much agenda-driven about, I really need to stay present for this. I am going to be mindful of this. And then I notice, poof, the mind's wandered. And I come back. It's like, I got lost. Better be mindful. And at some point in that process, being curious about the wandering, the wandering mind. And what I'm waking up into when the mind returns, sometimes and way more often than I would have thought initially, after a period of time when we have cultivated this wholesome quality of mindfulness, sometimes when the mind wanders, it's actually trying to find its way to letting go. Then it's trying to find its way to release. And in the waking up, sometimes we can, in that moment of waking up, just be curious, well, how is the mind right now? And more often than I would expect, after these years of practice, and now it's more often than not, actually, at this point, that when the mind returns, it's kind of just, it's not caught by anything in particular. It's more in a state of release or of letting go that the mind found its way to without my conscious awareness of it happening. And in the waking up into it, I can begin to recognize, oh, the mind was trying to find its way to wholesomeness. I kind of left my conscious mind behind because my conscious mind had some agenda. This is how I be mindful. This is how I need to be mindful. That was kind of an aside. So sometimes what I was pointing to there is sometimes the more we practice, sometimes when we are not mindful, sometimes the mind is actually not motivated by unwholesome habits, but by the wholesomeness of our practice. And we can rejoice in that when we return and see that our mind has released. So all of these aspects of full awareness, that we recognize the impermanent nature of experience, the conscious awareness, and the it brings in the understanding of skillful, unskillful, what's going on in the mind. So this, to me, brings in a whole, like, very three-dimensional aspect of what awareness of activities means. It's not just about sweeping and knowing sweeping. It's opening us to a much broader exploration of body-mind and how they interact and what leads us to freedom. I'm going to close with a poem encouraging this kind of awareness of bodily activities. As I read this poem, it basically, to me, it's indicating an awareness of activities. This is a fairly famous poem. Some of you may know it already. Plowing the field with plows, sowing the ground with seed, supporting their wives and children, young men gather up wealth. So why is it that I... This is by a nun, by the way, Patachara. Why is it that I, consummate in virtue, a doer of the teacher's bidding, don't gain unbinding? I'm not lazy or proud. This was a reflection going through her mind as she sat there. It said she's sitting out on a hillside watching people do their activities in the world. And so watching people plowing the fields and doing that external awareness. Then it moves to more internal awareness. Washing my feet, I notice the water. And in watching it flow from high to low, my heart was composed like a fine thoroughbred steed. Taking a lamp, I entered the hut, checked the bedding, sat down on the bed. And taking a pin, I pulled out the wick. Like the flames unbinding was the liberation of awareness. Through this activity of being present in daily life, this is her story of full awakening. being aware of washing her feet, aware of walking to her room, aware of checking the bed, aware of putting out the light. The light goes out, the mind is freed. It can happen anytime. Freedom is not something that would only happen sitting on the cushion in meditation. Let's sit for a moment. In a very simple way, know that you're sitting. Know that you're breathing. Know that you're hearing.